I'm Carrie Thompson, and the folks here at NPR's Playback have a question we'd like you to ponder.
What is the most positive addition to modern life that you can think of over the last 10, 20 years?
Those little yellow pieces of paper that you can write notes on and stick them to the wall, you know what I mean?
Yep, I know what you mean. They're called Post-its. And second in importance to Post-its, the most positive addition to modern life is Playback, the only podcast that plunges blindly into the NPR archives to come up with choice entertainment from 25 years ago. This month, it's October 1985, and we feature an unusually star-studded lineup with the original Catwoman, Eartha Kitt.
I was banned in Boston for singing I Want to Be Evil. Can you believe this? And it's a very simple song. It's very innocent.
And the gods of radio serendipity pair up a young Ira Glass and former President Richard Nixon.
They often ask, they say, how would you evaluate your public life? What are you most proud of?
We also have profiles of singer Patsy Cline, filmmaker Orson Welles, and a visit with that nutty dude, Mo Moskowitz.
You got a record there on the turntable? Oh, this will be great.
Chances are you're still wondering what gives with that Ira Glass Richard Nixon story. I am here to reassure you that Nixon did not make a guest appearance on This American Life, but Ira Glass did show up at a dinner honoring Mr. Nixon in October 1985. It was the first GOP function sponsored by African Americans to pay tribute to Mr. Nixon since he resigned from office in 1974.
The official purpose of last night's dinner was to honor both former President Richard Nixon and his first Secretary of Commerce, Maurice Stans, for creating the Office of Minority Business Enterprise. Fred Brown, chairman of the National Black Republican Council, said that the day that Nixon signed that executive order would never be forgotten.
President Nixon, let the record clearly show that you, without any doubt, was the creator of black capitalism in this country.
While recalling these achievements, speakers ignored Watergate and Secretary Stans' involvement as finance chairman of the Committee to Re-elect the President. Rewriting the history of the Nixon years was clearly on a lot of people's minds. One former staffer told the crowd there is already a consensus about the superiority of Nixon's foreign policy to that of other presidents, and that soon historians would acknowledge the accomplishments of his domestic policy. Later, President Nixon picked up the theme.
And I try to think of an answer to a question that my friends in the media often ask. My friends, I have some. But in any event, they often ask, they say, how would you evaluate your public life? What are you most proud of? But as I look back over those 40 years, there is nothing that we have achieved for which I am more proud than these two things that have been mentioned tonight. One, the peaceful desegregation of Southern schools, and two, the record that we make in terms of minority business enterprise, in which thousands of black Americans have been able to see the American dream come true in their own lives.
Several of the Nixon programs for black businesses celebrated by the black Republicans last night have already been trimmed by the current Republican administration. For example, low-interest loans for minority businesses. But Mr. Nixon did not allude to any disagreements with Reagan administration policies. He began his speech with praise for President Reagan and wholeheartedly embraced one of the administration's most controversial positions against quotas that favor minorities in hiring. Ironically, many of the rich black businessmen at the fundraiser have been beneficiaries of a kind of quota, a provision of U.S. law which says that a certain portion of government contracts have to go to minority businesses. Since the Nixon administration began enforcing this rule in 1969, government purchases from minorities have risen from $8 million a year to $5 billion a year.
So had not been for that program, I doubt seriously whether I would have grown as much as I did.
Carl Willacy, a co-owner of the Vanguard Oil Company in Brooklyn. Like other black Republican entrepreneurs, he lamented technical rule changes under Reagan that make it harder for minority businesses to get government contracts.
Oh, Reagan is a total disaster.
Mr. Nixon, unlike some in the Reagan administration, believes the special provisions for minority contractors should continue, that they are different from a quota. On these and other issues, some black Republicans prefer Nixon's approach to Reagan's. But But when asked if the purpose of honoring Nixon was to send a political message to the administration about the proper way to treat black business, Fred Brown's response was like that of a lot of black Republicans.
We feel that Reagan has done an excellent job.
He then went on to say that he would like it if black Republicans could sit down with the president and administration officials to stop once and for all persistent rumors about further cuts in support for minority businesses. For National Public Radio in New York, I'm Ira Glass.
And now, Bob Edwards talks to singer, actress, and professional feline impersonator, Eartha Kitt.
In America, when you make a mark in the beginning and people get to know you as that particular kind of, I want to be evil, cat-like, feline, you know, sensuous, blah, 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 then I think the companies sort of stick to that one particular category, whereby in Europe, they also see the other side of you.
Well, the American Eartha Kitt has endured.
Thank heavens for that. I'm very glad this has happened, you know. Even when you get into areas like this last record that I have out, I Love Men, Where Is My Man? They are like, well, when they think in terms of Eartha Kitt, I think they think in terms of her singing double entendre songs, but I never have sung, quote-unquote, a naughty song in my whole life. As a matter of fact, I was banned in Boston for singing I Want to Be Evil. Can you believe this? And it's a very simple song. It's very innocent. It's, I want to be evil. I want to spit tax. I want to be evil and cheat at jacks. Now, is that double entendre to you, or is that a mischievous song? Oh, Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Being an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Is that evil? But it's songs that I love them because they're all tongue-in-cheek. And I think I laugh more at myself than probably the public does.
Some of us learned our first French from you.
Yeah, c'est si bon.
Mm-hmm.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où, bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons.
It's a very interesting thing about c'est si bon. I remember when I first started in the business on my own after leaving the ballet company in Paris. This was the song that the impresarios told me that I should sing because it was terribly popular at that time. This was like 1950, 1951. And it was the first engagement after my ballet company life. I was with the ballet company for 5 years. And that was a Boeuf sur le Toit in Brussels. And it was an afternoon matinee. And, of course, I walked out on the stage and I saw nothing but women, which I like women, mind you, but I'm also used to having a few men in the audience, you know, because of the kind of songs you sing. And there were no men in the audience at all. When I got to C'est si bon, I could not remember anything except C'est si bon, C'est si bon, C'est si bon. So I ad-libbed the whole thing. And that is what you hear on the record, and it won 5 gold medal awards.
En chantant des chansons. Quel esprit.
There was a blessedly good harvest the year Eartha Kitt was born in the tiny town of North, South Carolina. So her sharecropper parents named her to give thanks to the earth. Kitt was orphaned as a child, and an aunt living in Harlem took her in. Eartha Kitt danced her way into show business, and when her dance company appeared in Paris, Kitt stayed behind to become the queen of Parisian cabarets. Eartha Kitt returned to the United States in the early 50s, and though her opportunities were somewhat limited by her color, she appeared on Broadway in sold-out nightclub performances, television, and films. By the late 60s, Eartha Kitt's career began to slide. It was only later she discovered that it was because of her frank criticism of the Vietnam War during a visit to the White House.
I was asked to the White House by Mrs. Johnson to give my opinions about the problems of America at that time. That's what the luncheon invitation was all about. And when this happened to me, when President Johnson So it says on my dossier, he picked up the telephone and called the networks across the nation and said, I do not want to see that woman's face on the air. I didn't know anything about it until 1974, and this happened in 1968. And I was wondering what was the reason that these contracts that I had for hotels here and there and nightclubs here and there across America, suddenly the contracts didn't exist anymore. But, you know, you kind of think, well, maybe you don't have a hit record right now and blah, 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 blah. Since I didn't know exactly what was going on, I didn't know how to treat the situation. But when I found out about this, when Seymour Hersh called me in 1974 and told me that there was this dossier on me, you don't know if you want to laugh or cry because you say, in my own country, this happened.
Our file here isn't as big as the Secret Service dossier, but I'm curious about something that's missing from all the biographies I read about you. They all go from an unhappy childhood in South Carolina to show business. And somewhere along the way, you acquired quite an education, and I can't place where that would be.
In show business. It was also a means of me getting myself off the streets. It was a means for me to do some traveling and getting away from my aunt. And because of that experience, you keep your ears and eyes open and you learn everything that goes on around you.
I wanna be evil. I wanna spit tax. I wanna be evil and cheat at jacks. I wanna be wicked. I wanna tell lies. I wanna be mean and throw my pies.
Orson Welles passed away in October 85. He was known for his work in theater, radio, and film, and for directing and starring in that most famous movie, which can be summed up in one word.
He was the man who panicked America, the man who made Hollywood grow up. He was an egotist, a tyrant, and a genius. And like so many of the artists to whom we attach that last word, Orson Welles achieved much in his early years. He played the violin for Stravinsky and Ravel at age 7, performed in Shakespeare at the age of 10, and even as a youth, his ego was legendary. Nearly everyone who met him was impressed with him, but none were as impressed with his talent as Welles himself. His formal schooling ended when he was 15, but by that time he was an accomplished painter, musician, and actor. Claiming to be a famous American actor, he conned his way onto the Irish stage at age 16, but it was on his return to America that his career blossomed. At 22, with John Houseman, he founded the Mercury Theater in New York, producing, directing, and starring in productions that rocked the theater establishment. A fascist Julius Caesar, an all-black so-called voodoo Macbeth, the Mark Blitzstein opera The Cradle Will Rock. But that scarcely kept him occupied. At the same time, he was doing 12 to 15 weekly radio shows. And at 23, he panicked America with the radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. Listeners really believed the nation was being invaded by Martians.
Now, nearer home, comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius...
But Welles needed new worlds to conquer. 3 years later, the boy wonder made his Hollywood directing debut. At the age of 26, he unveiled what is certainly his masterwork, producing, directing, and starring in Citizen Kane.
I don't see why you have to go straight out to the newspaper.
You know, I should have married a newspaper man. They're worse than sailors. I absolutely adore you.
Oh, Charles, even newspaper men have to sleep.
I'll call Mr. Bernstein, have him put off my appointments until noon.
Citizen Kane changed the way we saw film. Its flashbacks, quick cuts, even the camera angles were revolutionary. Audiences were used to filmmaking that was very much like theater, linear plots told in linear ways. Welles established that the public was more sophisticated than that, and he wrote the book on film grammar. He invented the fast-paced editing effects that are now used and abused so frequently they've become a cliché. Miami Vice couldn't exist without him. But oddly, while his techniques were adopted by the industry, Welles was cast aside. When he resisted the efforts of insensitive Hollywood studios to re-edit his films during the 40s and 50s to make them more conventional, he was labeled a troublemaker, and that reputation for dissent stuck with him through the rest of his his career. He fled to Europe, where he hired out as an actor in other people's projects to finance his own movies. But the last 25 years of his life were marked by a series of aborted or unfinished projects. He did wine commercials and dreamed of filming Shakespeare's gargantuan epic, King Lear. In many ways, it was his own story, rejected by those he'd nurtured, railing against the elements, held back by his own stubbornness and resistance to compromise. A huge man in every sense of the word, but hugely vulnerable, too, and irreplaceable. Orson Welles died today at the age of 70. I'm Bob Mondello.
Mr. Bernstein is apt to pay a visit to the nursery now and then.
Does he have to?
Yes.
Really, Charles? People will think...
What I tell them to think.
Wasn't he ever in love with her?
He married for love. Love. That's why he did everything. That's why he went into politics. It seems we weren't enough. He wanted all the voters to love him, too. That's all he really wanted out of life was love. That's Charlie's story, how he lost it.
That report on Orson Welles from NPR's Bob Mondello. In October 85, the film Sweet Dreams was released. It featured the story of singer Patsy Cline. Here's a profile from reporter Alex Chadwick.
In conjunction with the new TriStar release, Sweet Dreams, Q102 presents the Sweet Dreams Talent Contest, Saturday evening at 7 p.m. at the Delco Plaza. I go out walking
after Sweet Dreams opens Thursday night in Winchester, Virginia, an event of importance for the town. Winchester is the place Patsy Cline left behind, and it's where she finally returned, a small southern country city in a corner of the state near where the mountains of West Virginia begin. For the cost of a quarter, you can hear Patsy Cline's voice again in a roadside tavern where she used to order a beer. At a drugstore downtown where she once worked, her old soda fountain is now part of the storage room, but the manager will take you back for a look. All over Winchester, people bring out Patsy Cline's stories like small packages to be unwrapped and explored and then put away again. Oddly, much of what you hear doesn't match up.
You must remember, she was a good-looking young lady, right?
Patsy wasn't a beauty queen. She had a lot of talent, but when she wasn't made up, her face would stop a clock.
Patsy Cline drank too much, or she didn't. She was extremely difficult to get along with, or she was kind and warm and outgoing. From the stories, Patsy Cline might have been two or three or four people, except for the boys.
I've never known anyone in my life, male or female, that could sing as well as Patsy Cline could. Never.
She knew how to project, she knew how to sing, and she knew, you know, how to cry. She could cry a song and the tears would run right down her cheeks. She felt what she was singing.
She could make everybody stop. Play the slot machines when she got finished.
Patsy comes on stage, they just all quit dancing and come and watch her. She had that magnetism that just drawed you to her.
Her father abandoned the family. She quit school to work and help her mother support the home and the other children. But she wanted to sing. Jimmy McCoy had a hillbilly band that played at a local radio station.
Saturday mornings at WINC, we had live country music shows, and I had a little band there called the Melody Playboys, and we all did a half hour live, and they had a large picture window that people from off the street could just come in and watch the shows on Saturday morning. And this good-looking girl, she showed up three or four Saturday mornings and stood there peeping through the window, and a lot of times with her nose right up to the window, flatten her nose out, you know. After a few weeks, she said, I'd like to sing. Somebody in the band said, well, let her sing. Of course, after we heard her sing, everybody knew that, hey, we got somebody here that's entirely different.
There are places where it's an awful lot easier to make money than rural Virginia, but there probably isn't better ground for a country singer to try to get started. People there love the music. So Patsy Cline sang her way through a succession of bands, and she played high schools, legion halls, beer joints, taverns, until finally she was known all over the region, and even a little beyond it.
Oh, I love you. Granny, this ain't like New York, but it's uptown. Doggies, you talk about a hen out of a coop. I really felt like one up there. I'm a-telling you. But you know what? We made them show their true colors. We brought that country out of them, if anybody did. They're sitting up there stomping their feet and yelling just like a bunch of hillbillies, just like we do. We were awfully proud of having the opportunity to go that fur up in high cotton. Here's one that I did up there, and it done pretty good. Got an encore on it. I guess you'd call it pretty good. Give me about an A chord. See if y'all recognize. Hey, won't you come home, Bill Bailey? Won't you come home? I pull the whole day long. I lose the cooking, honey. I'll pay the rent. I know I've done you wrong. Remember that rainy day that I drove you out with nothing but a fine tooth comb. But I know that I'm to blame. And ain't that a shame, Bill Bailey, won't you please come home?
You had a band and were playing around in clubs in this area then?
Right.
What was it like?
Well, when we talk hillbilly, and we were called hillbillies in those days, and a lot of people didn't want to admit to that, but Patsy Cline could sing pop songs. You know, she was back, even in those days, she could do whatever the pop song of the day was. Songs like Bill Bailey, Won't You Come Home.
The ambition was so big, and the voice was so big, and Winchester wasn't. She got a chance to sing on Arthur Godfrey's National Talent Search TV show. She was spectacular. Winchester, Virginia had produced a star, one who quickly moved to Nashville and began recording there. When Patsy Cline went back to Winchester for a visit, she'd be driving a white Cadillac with her latest release in the trunk. But Jimmy McCoy remembers she'd stop at his station, and sometimes, in the mail, he'd get a tape from Nashville.
Hello, folks. Well, it's true that I'm coming to you by way of tape recorder here, but it's awful nice to be able to talk to you even this way, over station WHPL. And, of course, my good friend and yours, Jimmy McCoy, he's right here to play some of your favorite records for you. And from the nice reports I've been getting, thanks to all you nice folks, you've made my I Fall to Pieces on the Decca label number one. And I sincerely appreciate it. And thanks again for letting me come in and talk with you just a little while.
Patsy Cline kept on making hits, one big record after another. She became the top female country singer, maybe as big as Hank Williams. From about 1960 on, almost everything she recorded was a hit. Then in the early spring of 1963, flying back to Nashville from a concert, with her manager and musicians Cowboy Copas and Hawkshaw Hawkins, Patsy Cline's plane hit a mountain. There were no survivors. She was 31.
It was in the springtime that you said goodbye. I remember our faded love.
They say 15,000 people came to the funeral at the small cemetery outside Winchester. And even now, a couple of dozen cars a week stop there. And every March, on the anniversary of the plane crash, Jimmy McCoy sorts through old records and tapes to do another memorial show about the kid he let sing one day, long ago at a little radio station, out in hillbilly country.
Do you have a favorite song of Patsy Cline's?
Yeah.
What is it?
Sweet Dreams. I think that's one of the greatest. And then the way she ended, Faded Love. For anybody would ever listen to the last few notes of Faded Love, they would know what she was all about.
And remember her faded love.
Now, we're pretty sure our next guest had a regular day job, but for some reason, at certain festive times of the year, he would show up at NPR.
Good morning, Bob. This is Mo Moskowitz, public radio's favorite producer, promoter, movie mogul, and maitre d'. Party of two, upstairs.
So now you're in the restaurant business?
Oh, they call me the Nabob of Nosh. But I'm not here to talk about restaurants, Bob. I'm here to talk about Moe's Halloween party tips. Here, look at this. I got a whole trunk full of stuff here, Bob. My Foot Locker of Phantasmagoria. Look at this, a giant illuminated pumpkin. You stick it on your head. Isn't that funny? Here, look at this. Novelty record album.
Guaranteed to make your Halloween party a nightmare.
Or your money back. What do you think?
Do I get to sing on this one?
That comes later on in the bit, Bob. Now, I call this record Moe's Thrilling, Chilling Sounds of Horror. The world's most terrifying sounds. Listen.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And if you think that's scary, listen to this.
Okay, now just the bar mitzvah boy. Push your right foot in. You push your right foot out. Come on, Stevie. Put your right foot in. And you shake it all about. Now just the grandma's a hokey pokey.
Now that's what I call real scary, Bob. And listen to this bonus 45.
Do I get to sing on this one?
Later on, Bob, I told you. Listen to this hit song. It's about a couple of factory workers on Halloween night, and they're watching all these kids getting candy for free, you know, while they gotta load this big truck. Listen. Look at them kids. That's the way you do it. Trick-or-treating while we load this machine. That's the way you do it. Dress up like the A-Team. Candy for nothing on Halloween. We gotta move these Jumbo Mr. Goodbars. We gotta pack these Tootsie Roll Pops. We gotta move these Yankee Doodles. Candy for nothing on Halloween. With a record like that, Bob, anybody can be the life of the Halloween party. But it's not the record that's important, Bob. It's what you play the record on. Here, take a look at this machine.
It looks like some kind of phonograph.
Graphophone, Bob. This is completely different. Look, you bring this machine to your Halloween party. You gotta get a couple of friends to help you set it up, you know what I mean? Here, let me demonstrate. You got a record there on the turntable? Oh, this'll be great. Now, you see, you get to sing along, Bob. You get to make a hit record. Here, look, I got the lyric sheet right here. I typed out all the words. Here. Go on, go on. Somebody from Warner Brothers Records might be listening.
There's a place where I can go and tell my secrets to in my room.
That is brilliant. That is what that. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Edwards. Bob Edwards, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Edwards. Do you want more? Out there, do you want more? Up in the balcony, do you want more? Do you want Bob Edwards, ladies and gentlemen? What do you think, Bob?
I'd like to buy 40 copies of that record.
Oh, great. They're $16 a piece.
Well, maybe I'll start with one.
Start with two, Bob. I could use a decent breakfast. Oh, listen to that. Ooh, I gotta run, Bob. Somebody wants to buy a pumpkin. You want one? I got a half-price special on the rotten ones. This is Mo Moskowitz and the Punsters. Say hi, boys.
Hello.
Wishing all my friends at National Public Radio a happy Halloween.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mo Moskowitz.
It's so good to hear from Mr. Moskowitz again. Next month, we move on to November 1985. The comic strip Calvin and Hobbes debuts in 35 newspapers across the U.S., and Microsoft comes up with Windows 1.0. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.